Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. U.S. Envoy Anthony Zinni arrives in Israel tomorrow, and with him, hope against hope for some glimmer of life in the region's shattered peace process. But on the ground, peace seems bitterly elusive. Today, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon ordered troops to press ahead with a full offensive on the occupied territories. Palestinian attacks on Israelis have been unrelenting for months. This hour, the price of an endless conflict and the search for a way to peace. We begin with the latest on the ground in Jerusalem. I spoke earlier today with Cameron Barr. He's correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor. I asked him to describe the situation that U.S. Envoy General Anthony Zinni flies into when he arrives in the region tomorrow.
Well, he's flying into what will probably turn out to be a momentary lull. Of course, there was violence today, but not in comparison with some of the really disastrous situations we've witnessed in the past few days. Having been here for some time, I can only predict that there will probably be something terrible shortly after he arrives. There will be some sort of Palestinian attack. And, of course, there are major Israeli military operations underway in the Palestinian territories. So all told, the situation is very tense. At the same time, people are happy to see him come. It shows a level of concern and commitment from the United States that we have not seen in quite a while. But I don't think anyone is terribly optimistic about what he can achieve. I talked to a very senior Israeli intelligence guy, and he said he was not optimistic because they have no faith that the Palestinians can live up to their commitments. They have no faith that the political situation among the Palestinians is ready for a ceasefire without some sort of major political concession from the Israelis. And he said, of course, that's impossible for us, which is probably an accurate political assessment. On the Palestinian side, there's sort of an equal level of skepticism because they feel that the Americans have allowed the Israelis to run rampant in the territories to kill dozens and dozens of Palestinians in recent days. And so they're not terribly optimistic about a ceasefire either.
How has the new or recent statement by the UN Security Council been received by the Israelis, by the Palestinians? Is it seen as significant or not?
I think over the course of time, it will be seen as significant. Just as last year in November, we had a sort of similar utterance from the Secretary of State and from President Bush, a reference to a Palestinian state. I mean, that's a gratifying development for the Palestinians, and it may be sort of an affordable political concession that the Israelis can offer them. It doesn't cost Ariel Sharon much, the Prime Minister of Israel, much to have this resolution go forward in the United Nations. I mean, he's paying a higher political price here for backing off of a condition that he insisted on for many, many months, which was that there had to be a week of absolute calm before any ceasefire could be set to begin. And he's backed off of that, and that's cost him a couple of cabinet ministers from the right, from the more hawkish side of the Israeli political spectrum. So he may be worried about that. I'm sure he is worried about that, and I'm sure he's worried about what his main rival, the former prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, will do with a kind of ferment among conservative hawkish Israelis who may be frustrated with Sharon's performance.
UN Secretary General Kofi Annan was tough on both Israelis and Palestinians yesterday, especially tough on the Israelis. How's that been received in Israel?
Well, Israelis have no love for the UN. They feel like the UN is stacked against them, that there are, you know, there are so many Arab and Islamic countries who will vote against Israel on any issue, so that they don't have a lot of time for the United Nations. But you're right, the language has been very, very tough. Mr. Annan's representative here, Terry Larson, was today saying that, you know, we are in the abyss. There are rivers of blood every day, and this is a kind of rhetoric that may accurately describe the situation, but it's also fairly extreme coming from diplomats who are more used to more sober expressions.
Cameron Barr, is there a path open for conversations even to begin again? What exactly will General Zinni be doing there? Is there any chance of him bringing together representatives of each side?
I think there is. Even this week, there have been meetings with between senior Palestinian and Israeli officials. They tend to go on no matter what. In his first attempts here, he sought to bring about a ceasefire by attempting to guarantee security on both sides, calming both sides in security terms. And that, of course, is very gratifying to the Israelis. That's what they care most about. And according to diplomats I've spoken to, he really applied most of his pressure on Yasser Arafat and almost none on Ariel Sharon. So what I've been hearing from diplomats, Western diplomats, European ones, some American ones as well, is that this time pressure has to be applied on both sides. So presumably that will be a change of course for him. And the UN is saying very explicitly, very clearly today in a press conference that there had to be a focus not just on security but also on politics, on, you know, creating some sort of vision for the future, what the Palestinians can hope to achieve, and also in economic terms, because the UN, in its humanitarian role here, is very, very concerned about a situation where the Palestinian poverty rate has doubled since the beginning of this period of conflict, where something like, they've calculated there's $300 million worth of physical damage in the territories. Most of that has been caused by the Israeli military. So, you know, they're also pushing for economic action rapidly to try to sustain the Palestinian economy and, to keep people from feeling, ever greater levels of despair.
Cameron Barr, is there any sense that the shocking bloodletting of the last few weeks may actually push people back to peace talks, or is it more the sense that that Israelis and Palestinians are still in a kind of death struggle there?
There's a strong sense of continuing death struggle, I have to say that. There is some positive repercussion in the more engaged response of the United States. There's more than one reason for that. It's not just purely a response to, as you put it, the shocking bloodletting. It's also a desire to advance the U.S. foreign policy agenda vis-a-vis Iraq, and I think a growing recognition, which the vice president is hearing from the Arab leaders that he's meeting this week, that if the United States is to win regional acquiescence for some sort of move against the Iraqis, that it will certainly have to do more to ease the situation, if not, make a concerted effort to solve it. That, of course, poses huge problems in Washington, where deep, intimate, intricate involvement in the Middle East is equated with the Clinton administration and equated with a loss of presidential prestige, with a waste of presidential time. So there's great reluctance to do that, especially from a first-term president. Most American presidents only really wade into the Middle East in their second term when they, don't have to worry about an election. So I think the bloodletting has brought about that engagement. That's a positive thing. Whether it's really been enough to shock these two peoples into some new awareness, I don't think I'd go that far yet.
Cameron Barr is a correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor in Jerusalem. At least 1,058 Palestinians and 341 Israelis have been killed in the past year and a half of fighting. Still, the violence continues to dramatically escalate, even as the international community calls out for its end. In an important symbolic move this week, the United Nations Security Council passed a resolution describing a vision of a Palestinian state coexisting with Israel. The U.S. is sending Special Envoy Anthony Zinni to the region, his third attempt to promote peace since November. Even the Pope is calling for an end to the killing. As the fighting goes on and on, what is the price to Israelis, to Palestinians, to the world? There has to be a way out of this horror. What is it? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us in the studio tonight is H.D.S. Greenway. He's a columnist with the Boston Globe, a former Washington Post bureau chief in Jerusalem, and has just returned from his first visit to Jerusalem since 1996. Good evening and welcome, David Greenway.
Good evening.
Also joining us from Washington, D.C. is Ambassador Dennis Ross. He's a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and was the key U.S. point person for Middle East peace process in both the first Bush White House and the Clinton administration. Good evening and welcome, Dennis Ross.
Good evening.
Also with us, our own On Point news analyst, Jack Beattie, here tonight in the studio. Welcome, Jack. It's good to have you right here.
Good evening.
Dennis Ross, you've been a great and enlightening guest for us on many occasions, and we thank you for coming back tonight. The scale of conflict has reached new heights, at least new in recent decades. We want to step way back tonight before we look at the way out of this thing, and would give us your help. Help us size up the price of this never-ending conflict in blood, in psychic wounds, in global tension and conflict and lost opportunities for peace and its fruits to everybody, to the Israelis, to Palestinians, to the region, the world, the U.S. What is the cost of this ongoing thing? Give us the framework in which we should see it.
Well, certainly the cost for Israelis and Palestinians is measured not only in terms of blood, but it's also measured in terms of psychology. I am one of those who have always been very skeptical of the idea that in a conflict like this, you wait until each side exhausts itself. Because the fact is, A, they never get to the point of exhausting themselves, and B, in the process, one casualty is not only those who were lost, those who were killed, but it's also the belief in peace itself. And what happens is that ideas that are very extreme, that would never have currency in a different environment, gain a kind of credibility that they would not have otherwise. In Israel today, 46% of the Israeli public is now saying they support the idea of transfer of Palestinian populations out of the territories, which would have been unthinkable before.
And what exactly would that mean, as in transferring them to, let's say, Jordan?
Yeah, it's an impossible.
So a mass ejection.
Morally wrong, mm-hmm. physically wrong, practically impossible.
Mm-hmm.
But it reflects the people who are feeling vulnerable, angry, fearful, insecure. And the Palestinians have their own extremes now who are saying the answer is to keep this up because not only will it drive the Israelis out of the West Bank and Gaza, but it will drive them out of Israel. And that's just as much an illusion. Mm-hmm. But it's the consequence of letting a conflict of this sort not only fester, but get to the point where the bloodletting is what we've seen. So there's an immediate price that is paid in terms of making extreme ideas somehow more tolerable and
moderation gets pushed off the field. How about the price to this region for countries in the region and I guess for the world and the U.S. in the region of this conflict going on?
Well, certainly for us in the region, it obviously tends to deepen the level of anger and alienation from us. There are all sorts of reasons for anger and alienation among Arab publics. From their regimes, they're dissatisfied with the lack of hope, the possibility of participation economically and politically. But the fact of the matter is they visit most of that anger and frustration onto us. And this conflict at this point makes it far easier to do so. We're held accountable for what the Israelis do. And what happens on a nightly basis is the Arab publics are fed a daily diet of the most brutalizing images of the Israelis with very little shown on the other side of it, what's happened, what is done
mm-hmm.
to Israelis.
Mm-hmm. What is the cost of that linkage to the United States today and tomorrow?
Well, I think first, if in fact we are determined to remove Saddam Hussein, which I think is an objective of the administration, we can do that, but we're going to find it far more difficult to do it in an environment where we have nobody in the region who's prepared to sign up to that effort.
Mm-hmm.
And their readiness to sign up to that effort is partly a function of our looking like we're going to succeed, but it's largely also a function of them feeling that being associated with us doesn't carry a very high price.
Mm-hmm. David Greenway, you're just back from the region. We're hearing from Dennis Ross, the price to Israelis and Palestinians, very steep. The regional price, both for countries there and for the U.S. How do you calculate the price of this unending conflict?
Well, I think that Dennis Ross alluded to this in just what he finished saying, that Arab leaders would fear to be associated too closely to us if we don't get involved and try to do something to calm the situation down. I think Jordan is terrified of a spillover, and I think Egypt is nervous, too, that the popular opinion in the so-called Arab street might get out of hand. And another cost of this is the moderate Arab leaders who would like to be our friends.
Jack Beatty, Tom Friedman said over the weekend in the New York Times that this conflict could be the fuse to a clash of civilizations. Do you see that possibility brewing here?
Well, that's apocalyptic. He also said that if the Israelis think they can essentially do what Prime Minister Sharon said they wanted to do, smash the Palestinians into compliance, people had better cancel their Israel bonds. That was a dead end. The trouble is that this is, you know, it used to be the Cold War that led anxiety to this, the nuclear trigger leading out to the alliance systems. Now it's this clash of civilizations that's having a worldwide, you know, it's lending that echo of absolute menace to this whole thing, quite in the way that the old Cold War alliances did.
We're looking at the cost of crisis in the Middle East tonight. We'll go on to try and find a way out of this seeming impasse. How do we get out of the bloody Israeli-Palestinian impasse? What is the path to hope in this conflict, in this war? What price is the world paying for this endless conflict? The price to Israel, to the Palestinians, to the region, to the United States. Is it a tolerable price anymore? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the cost of crisis in the Middle East tonight and the way out of the unending conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. Where is the path to peace in the Middle East? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by Ambassador Dennis Ross, who was the point person for the United States in both the first Bush White House and the Clinton administration in Middle East peace negotiations, by Boston Globe correspondent and former Jerusalem bureau chief for the Washington Post, David Greenway, and by our own news analyst, Jack Beatty. Dennis Ross, what do you make of Tom Friedman's formulation over the weekend in the New York Times that the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is starting to feel like the fuse for a much larger war of civilizations that would pull in the United States?
I am not someone who believes in apocalyptic visions, and I tend to focus more on what is the nature of the problem that you face now, how do you contain the escalation. Where do you go from there?
But you are familiar with risk assessment.
Yes, I certainly am.
Mm-hmm. Intimately.
I would say what worries me is not so much that the apocalyptic vision is out there. What worries me is that if you socialize a whole generation to see the world in a way that defies reality, that creates a set of mythologies, that creates anger as an approach towards the world, you're going to see different expressions of that. Terror is obviously one form of it.
Mm-hmm.
What Tom was, in a sense, getting at was the idea that you'll marry that anger with weapons of mass destruction at some point.
Mm-hmm.
And what you have to do is you have to break that nexus. And you don't do it only through military means. You're going to have to do it by dealing with some of the sources of the anger on the one hand, and also by getting leaders in the area, especially Arab leaders in the area, to tell the truth about what the source of certain problems are. I mean, it is astounding that 60% of the Arab world says they don't believe Arabs were responsible for September 11th.
It is astounding.
And one of the reasons they believe that is because nobody in their societies is saying to them, hey, look, yes, these were people who did it. They're renegades. They don't represent who we are. They don't represent Islam. They represent a perversion of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
They're not saying that.
The tyranny of mythology breeds this problem.
And that is a source of much greater worry to me, especially given what the demographics are in the Middle East, where such a high percentage of the populations are under the age of 25. And if they don't have hope, and if they don't have possibility, and if they're fueled by anger, then you're going to see them attract to the kind of movements that are obviously characterized not just by hostility, but by a glorification of violence. Mm. That's one of the things we have to contend with. Mm.
David Greenway, you're just back from both Israel and the West Bank. Give us a sense of the mood among Israelis, Israeli morale, and Palestinian mood and morale.
Well, I think the Israelis are traumatized. They see the horror of Beirut and Lebanon coming down to reach them. There were never suicide bombings in Israel before the Lebanon experience. That came with Hezbollah. And we're now in a full-stage guerrilla warfare right on their back door. The suicide bombings are really hard to take, as you can imagine. The left is in despair about Sharon. The right is in despair that Sharon's not doing enough. But I remember Hanok Smith, one of the pollsters in Israel, always used to say, "There's no public opinion in Israel; there's only public mood." And I think that 46% of people who want to indulge in ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians, I don't think that would stand up if conditions got better. I think that's just something you tell pollsters when you're angry.
And the Palestinians, David?
Palestinians are really, I think, feeling they have nowhere to go, that they have reached such a despairing bottom that the only thing to do is lash out. So, again, the extremists have the day, the sari nasebes, the moderates, are not being listened to. And the Palestinians always say that they can take more losses than can the Israelis. And that time is on their side. If they just keep at it, they can wear the Israelis down.
And Jack Beatty, yet there still remain the camps on both sides. You know, those, as Dennis Ross says, who would actually like to push the Palestinians out of the West Bank, the Palestinians who remain committed to the idea of pushing Israel out or at least going back to their homes, and devil take the hindmost for the Israelis.
Yeah, and at the root of that, I mean, the two outstanding issues that that maybe Dennis can address for us, you know, the Israelis tell the story about Oslo that's pretty much this, that it was a ruse, that the Palestinians were only acting, that while they were talking peace, their textbooks were teaching hatred. They were allowing a terror infrastructure to build. And all of this just burst, and sort of the scales dropped from the Israelis' eyes, and they realized they were dealing with a terrorist, and his name was Yasser Arafat. And the Palestinians, they tell the story that the Oslo process ended because of facts on the ground, because the settlements, 250,000 Israelis stuck like a fishbone in the throats of the people of the West Bank, and that these settlements were just there and undermining any political support for Oslo. And then the Israelis say, "Well, of course, you want us all to go—the right of return." And the Palestinians say, "The settlement. What about that? These two stories, Dennis Ross, the right of return and the settlements. I mean, is there?" You know, is there some kind of, can U.S. diplomacy get right here to address these questions, or is this just way down the road?
And let me chime in there. I'm sorry to keep bringing up Tom Friedman, but he says it may require a civil war on each side to resolve these very issues that Jack raises, Dennis Ross.
Well, let me say the following. I'm about three quarters of the way through writing a book that tells the whole story with an eye towards what is it we learn from it. Mm-hmm. And an answer to the question that Jack poses, there are things for us to learn from what went wrong with Oslo, as well as some of the things that were right with it. One of the things that was fundamentally wrong with it was the readiness to let commitments basically slide. There was no accountability. There was an enormous gap between what was being discussed at the table and what was permitted on the ground, on the street. For our part, we should have made it a ground rule for our involvement that if each side engaged in behaviors that were inconsistent with the purposes of the negotiations, we, for our part, wouldn't take part any longer. Both sides wanted us in. We needed to make it clear that there was a price for our admission, mm-hmm. and that we wouldn't be in regardless of their behavior. In a sense, what you're describing from each side's perspective is the classic example of what I confronted all the time. Each side was completely consumed by their own sense of grievance. The capacity to see the other side's grievance was profoundly limited. The Israelis were better at seeing the other side's grievance than the Palestinians, mm-hmm. because the Palestinians saw themselves being much more the victim. They were the occupied. They were the ones without power. They were the weak player. They couldn't have a generosity of spirit towards the Israelis where the Israelis were more capable of seeing the Palestinian side of things. The reality is that the Palestinians, in terms of a psychological transformation, never underwent it in Oslo because their textbooks continued to preach one thing, their media continued to preach one thing. There was constant incitement. There was not readiness or conditioning for peace. There was not any conditioning for compromise. At the same time, if the Israelis don't want the Palestinians to promote grievance, one of the things that they have to do is avoid those kinds of actions that make the Palestinians feel powerless. And that's where settlement activity, demolition of houses, comes into play. So I think if for the future, one of the things that has to happen is we need to create some ground rules for how we're going to operate. One ground rule should be a code of conduct on the part of each side in terms of what they will do consistent with what the requirements of negotiations are. Another ground rule on each side, I think, also has to be conditioning of publics for compromise. The Israelis during Barak's time were much better at that than the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. That could have been an interesting indicator for us about where Arafat was in fact coming from. Mm. Arafat was never put to the test until the very end of the administration, and then he was found wanting. But maybe had we required of him conditioning of publics, he would have been under greater pressure to then deliver more to demonstrate that what he was asking of his people could in fact produce.
Mm-hmm. Dennis Ross, please stand by. Our telephone lines are jammed, and I want to bring the callers into this conversation. Jeffrey is on the line. Welcome, Jeffrey. You're on the air.
Thank you. I have a question regarding the recent escalation in actions on part of the Israelis. Mm-hmm. Ariel Sharon's under a lot of pressure, both domestic and international, to make some concessions. I'm wondering if he has approved an escalation of actions in order to, when he sits down at the bargaining table, that he doesn't have to give up as much because he's making these other steps. I know I'm not doing as much as I did, so therefore I'm giving in some. And he's changed his negotiating position by increasing the actions recently.
So is he thrusting forward into the West Bank to have something to give up? Dennis Ross, I'm afraid this is right in your wheelhouse. What do you think about this latest Israeli offensive?
I don't know that it's related to what would be on the table, but I think it could very well be related to the arrival of General Zinni. One of the things that troubled me was the gap in time between the announcement of General Zinni's going and his arrival, which isn't until tomorrow. And I've seen this in the past where you create an opening, a window, and in a sense, one side or the other decides to get their licks in during that period. From the standpoint of Prime Minister Sharon, one could easily see him having engaged in a series of these military sweeps as a way of then being able to say, all right, look, we did what we had to do, and now we're prepared to take a step back. That certainly is a possibility.
David Greenway, you were just there. Was the air pregnant with anticipation of this kind of thrust by Israeli forces when you were there?
Well, yes. Sharon had made it very clear that his tactic was to beat them until they would submit. But could I ask Dennis Ross a question?
Please.
Dennis Ross, I wonder if we've talked about settlements and law of return. I wonder if you wouldn't agree that contiguity was also a problem at Oslo, that the Palestinian areas were so divided up in Zone A and so Zone B that when it came to actually make some changes on the ground with Palestinian control, there were actually more checkpoints than before, and people had trouble going from one area to another, which made the economy take a plunge. And I wonder if we were going back at this again, we would allow such a spotty plan for Palestinian control.
We've heard this critique from Sarah Roy at Harvard that Oslo was actually just unacceptable to Palestinians in the street because it left them feeling sort of caged, Dennis Ross.
Well, in a sense, it was unacceptable because there were other behaviors that highlighted that Israel control was not ending, but it was being cemented. In a sense, it wasn't so much the zones that produced that. It was the lack of a transformation in terms of truly being prepared to transfer authority in the way.
Lack of preparation on the part of Israelis.
There was a gap psychologically on the Israeli side between the political leadership and those who managed the relationship with Palestinians on a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. So the face of what the Palestinians saw on a day-to-day basis didn't change. The words were different, but the reality wasn't different. And then when you had acts of terror against Israelis in Israel, then the Israelis did the expected thing. They would clamp down. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, there's even one other interesting lesson that I've learned in reflecting back on this. One of the big mistakes was not so much the design of Oslo, but it was the implementation of Oslo. Mm. Early on in Oslo, there was a decision made to build connections between the two societies with an eye from the Palestinian standpoint to build a civil society. And they needed to expand the scope of their cooperation with the civil part of Israel. Early on, that was somehow subordinated to the security people on each side calling all the shots. And that tended to build the weight of the security people on the Palestinian side. It tended to diminish the possibility of building a civil society. Mm-hmm. That did damage to the Palestinians, created greater alienation from the Palestinian Authority, which was a source before the Intifada of a great deal of anger among Palestinians. And it also tended to reduce the connections between the two publics, which would have been critical to making it far more difficult to demonize, to stereotype, and to basically creating connections between publics and not barriers between publics.
Something for Americans to maybe listen to today when security guys are all in charge. It all revolves around security. John is on the line. Welcome, John. You're on the air.
Yes, well, how are you doing?
We're well, thank you, John.
Say, I'm just kind of curious, what kind of economic pressures can we bring to bear on this issue? Perhaps maybe we could withhold most favored nation trading status with Israel.
Well, Dennis Ross, how about it? John raises the issue of pressures that could be brought to bear. He cites one. You might take that one up. But what others? What can the international community do? Should we be thinking in a new way about how to treat this conflict?
Well, I don't know that the focus of the American effort right now should be that kind of pressure on Israel. I don't see that as being very productive in terms of getting the Israelis to be responsive. I think, on the contrary, that would get the Israelis to develop a siege mentality, and they'd be much less likely to be responsive. At one level, I would like to see us be much more engaged, much more interventionist.
What do you mean by that exactly? Do you mean back to the negotiating table or something more material?
Well, I mean, at a minimum, the United States needs to develop what is a clear policy of what it is we're trying to get done. Both the Tenet Plan and Mitchell are instruments. They're not objectives. We have basically treated them as if they were objectives.
Mm-hmm.
The administration, I think, needs to explain what it is it's trying to do, what its game plan is, how it's going to try to do that, why it's sending General Zinni out, not just because of Tenet and Mitchell, but where it fits in terms of what we're trying to get done,
mm-hmm.
what we're going to do in terms of holding each side accountable. If they're going to make commitments, what is required of them? What we're prepared to say if they don't fulfill their commitments?
And what if they just don't enter into this conversation at all? The notion of some kind of more muscular intervention is floating out there. You can feel it. People talk about it. On the other hand, William Safire writes that the very prospect of intervention by the U.S. or U.N. or Europeans gives Palestinian terrorists, he says, an incentive to prolong the bloodshed in hopes a horrified world will coerce Israel into submission.
Well, there's no doubt that I think in Arafat's mind he is extremely passive, and he doesn't mind if things get much worse in the hope that there'll be a kind of international intervention that imposes things. I don't think that's going to happen either, but I guess what I am saying is a little different. I'm not in favor of rewarding Arafat for basically acquiescing or allowing terrorism to take place. I'm prepared to be quite tough with him. I'm prepared to have us make it clear that when we put pressure on, there's a consequence. But what has to happen to give that credibility is we have to be engaged. You can't be in a position where only on occasion do you send an envoy out there, and only when you do does he have a very limited mandate.
Mm-hmm.
The mandate is to deal with a very narrow slice of security, not to deal with how you would construct a political process. I would basically create a timeline. I would create a timeline that relates to security, but I'd also create a timeline that relates to a political process. You have to do each in turn, but I'd also, to make the political process credible, I would create an agenda.
Mm.
I would put statehood on that agenda, because statehood as an issue is not contentious. The powers of the state, its borders, its relationship with Israel, all has to be negotiated. I would put disengagement on the agenda. You hear Israelis talking about unilateral separation. I would like to see them deal with the issue of disengagement, which is really the question of withdrawal, from the standpoint of, all right, how are we going to begin to negotiate that again? That creates a bridge to the future. I would like to see them put security arrangements on the table, how the two sides will cooperate, not only day-to-day right now, but how they would cooperate in circumstances where you have two states.
Dennis Ross, we're going to have to take a short break. I'm sorry, we'll come right back to that. We're talking about the cost of a crisis, the crisis in the Middle East, and where do we go next? How do we get out of the bloody Israeli-Palestinian impasse? What price is the world paying for this endless conflict, the price to Israel, the price to Palestinians, to the region, to the United States? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the cost of a crisis, the crisis in the Middle East, and where this thing can go next. Where is the path to peace in the Middle East? We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined tonight by Dennis Ross. He was point man for the first Bush White House and for the Clinton administration in extensive negotiations with Israelis and Palestinians. By David Greenway, Boston Globe columnist, formerly Washington Post bureau chief in Jerusalem, and by our own news analyst, Jack Beatty. There are a lot of you waiting to join, I know. Let's turn to the phones right now. Alex is on the line. Welcome, Alex. You're on the air.
Hi, we need an Occam's razor to this, and you said to yourself, what price does the world pay? So why don't we just buy the West Bank and Gaza Strip, the Palestinians take the money, we negotiate to buy a piece of, say, the Sinai on the Red Sea, and just literally construct a new country, a new Palestine. separate them by 1,000 miles and let's get on with life. This is totally foolish, and nothing will come out of all this yakking that keeps happening.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Alex, we feel your frustration. David Greenway, you've just been there. Can you imagine something way out of the box, something that money would somehow solve? Dennis Ross says he doesn't want to see Yasser Arafat rewarded for all this violence, but is there a way that international resources could be applied in a wholly new way to break this impasse?
I don't think it can be done by money, but I was told by several Fatah commanders that when Arafat asked them to try to calm down the violence, they said, look, chief, we can't get our people to stop the violence unless you can show that they're going to get something out of it. And I think the Palestinians now feel that after 17 months of what they've gone through, that they've got to get something, at least political, out of it.
Something like what?
Well, that's what I'd like to ask Dennis Ross. Perhaps this initiative about a Palestinian state would be enough of a carrot for them to step back from violence. But I'd love to hear what Dennis Ross thinks.
We're going to ask him, but Jack Beatty, pile on here first. I know you've looked at those settlements and said, if ultimately Israelis have to go, might there be something as simple as homes in this for Palestinians, or is that just outrageous to even consider?
Well, an Israeli columnist last week ventured that. He said that the Saudis, if they want peace, can spend money on the West Bank to essentially buy out the settlers, which would cost in the billions, and install the Palestinians so that it would be a sort of housing for Palestinians. It would buy out the Israelis. And he said, you know, if we can't have land for peace, let's have money for peace. Now, that may have been a sort of tongue-in-cheek proposal, but I hadn't seen anyone suggest any such creative use of not just Saudi rhetoric, but Saudi money.
Dennis Ross, how about it? Is there a political carrot? Is there a financial carrot that could put some dynamite into this thing and get it broken free?
Well, let me make a couple of points. First, when we were at Camp David, in fact, one of the things that was being offered is that settlements that were going to be evacuated were going to be given to the Palestinians. Hmm. So, in fact, that was actually something that was part of the discussions. I mean, one of the truly tragic things, when I hear many Palestinians say this is about ending the occupation, well, they had a chance to end the occupation when it was at the table. And unfortunately, they had a leader who wasn't prepared to take advantage of that. But be that as it may, right now, in terms of what I think it takes, is there will have to be a political dimension and there will have to be a financial dimension. I do think the idea of statehood, making the Palestinians, recognizing the Palestinians as a state now so that they could negotiate with the Israelis as a juridical equal, would have a psychological effect.
So an upfront recognition.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Now, it's not in all the territories. It would be, basically, it's the idea that Shimon Peres has been working with Abu Ala on, where you'd have, the Palestinians would have a state in the areas that constitute what are known as the A and B areas, which is about 40%.
Mm-hmm.
And they would then negotiate from that basis, but they would negotiate as equals, and in a sense, you could admit them to the UN, we would recognize them, assuming they were prepared to do what a state does. A state has one authority, it doesn't have multiple authorities.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to make it possible to do that, I think you're going to have the infusion of a tremendous amount of money, because the last 17 months have been absolutely destructive to the Palestinian economy.
Where's it going to come from?
I think it has to be international. I mean, we're going to have to step up to the plate for sure, but we're going to have to get others to do so. And the Saudis and the Gulf states should be prepared not only to express their concerns about what's happening to the Palestinians, but to also provide some money for them. I will tell you, the Gulf states have not been very good. Saudis have provided less money to the Palestinians since the beginning of the Oslo process than Norway has.
But they're nervous now. Can you imagine them finally digging into their deep pocket? They have their own risks on the line here.
They do have their own risks on the line, but you can't have it both ways. You can't, if you want to address what is a source of grievance in the area as a whole, then you also have to be prepared to make it easier for Palestinians.
Why wouldn't they do it? Because they're feeling poor, or because, in fact, they want to leave the irritant?
Well, there's no question it's been a lot easier to provide money to the Palestinians when the Palestinians were a threat to them than it has been to provide money to the Palestinians when they weren't. One of the things that's going to have to change is that even though they're not as flush with cash as they used to be, they're going to have to invest in this. It can't only be we who invest in this. They're going to have to invest in it. It can't just be the United States and the Europeans and the Japanese.
Mm.
The Gulf states are also going to have to do that, especially if they want us to play the kind of role which I would like to see us play. I think, again, there are certain ground rules for our involvement. everybody has to be responsible. We have a responsibility, and not being involved doesn't meet it.
Mm.
But by the same token, we can't succeed if we don't have Arab friends who aren't prepared to create a climate that gives us a chance to succeed.
Well, we'll soon see. Dennis Ross, stand by. Jeffrey is on the line. Good evening. Welcome, Jeffrey. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom, and it's a great show tonight. First, I want to thank Dennis Ross for all he's done to try to bring peace to the region. Two quick questions, probably for Dennis. One is, how important are the personalities? We saw Rabin and Arafat work well together. We haven't seen anything quite like that since Rabin's assassination. And secondly, I wonder if you could talk, as you eloquently do often, about what regular sort of grassroots kinds of things can be done to help move the situation forward and perhaps lay the groundwork for a time when peace and reconciliation aren't a dream but can become a reality.
Jeffrey, thanks for your call. Dennis Ross.
Let me start with the second point first. I think that one of the things that has to happen now is that we have to recognize that peace doesn't just come from the top down. You have to find ways to build it from the bottom up. Now, you're going to find it very difficult to do that in an environment where there continues to be violence. But I think one of the things that has to be created is something entirely revolutionary. We need to create a forum of ordinary Palestinians and Israelis who can meet together, it can be broadcast, and allow them to talk to each other about what they're each feeling. Right now, each side is so completely consumed with their own sense of hurt and grievance that they are incapable of seeing that the other side is in pain as well. Somehow there has to be, you have to begin to make it clear that each side has a problem and both sides are going to have to address it.
David Greenwood, before we go to the personality issue, grassroots potential here?
Yes, of course. It has to be done, and it's going to be much more difficult after all of this to get people to talk to each other. But if I could answer the question about where the personalities come into play.
Yes,
here.
Please. Sharon, Arafat.
You couldn't get a more poisonous combination than Yasser Arafat and Ariel Sharon. There's a personal bitterness that just seeps out when they talk about each other. Sharon saying he wished he'd had Arafat killed in 1982 in Beirut. And Sharon and Arafat speaking, going back to Beirut in his conversations. So you get this terrific enmity between these two personalities.
Mm. Peter's on the line. Welcome, Peter. You're on the air.
I think one thing is perhaps being overlooked here, and that is a central tenet of the most important kind, which is the division of the world in Islam between the Dar al-Islam, the domain of Islam,
mm-hmm.
and the Dar al-Harb, the domain of the infidel.
And how does it come to play here?
Well, it comes to play here as it does in all the borders of Islam. It is irrelevant what size Israel is. It is utterly irrelevant because if a non-Muslim sovereignty possesses land which is deemed to be Islamic, it doesn't matter if it's 10 times its current size or a tenth its current size, it is absolutely irrelevant. And not to make that a central focus of one's attention,
mm-hmm.
and to avoid, in fact...
So, Peter, you're effectively saying that the Islamic world will never, can never accept Israel's existence.
I'm saying that there's a complicated... It's not just Israel. I think if one wished to divide the southern Sudan into a black south... and as has been suggested, and a Muslim Arab North, that too would be resisted.
Mm. Peter, thank you for your call. I want to get that to Dennis. Dennis Ross, is it possible that Peter's suggesting this is just one of what we will or would see as an unending chain of such conflicts, that Islam must be in conflict with its neighbors? Do you agree? Is this inevitable?
I don't believe it's inevitable, but I am worried about an unending conflict now that does tend to radicalize the area in a way that gives that kind of sentiment much more weight, authority, and credence than it may have had before. Look, we have seen since Anwar Sadat went to Israel that there was a break in this phalanx of total rejection. Then we had the Madrid conference that made it legitimate to engage in direct discussions between Israelis and their neighbors. Then we had Oslo that basically produced mutual recognition between Israel and the PLO. All of that was creating a pathway that was designed to make it clear that indeed the Islamic world could live with minorities, could live with a Jewish state in its midst.
Mm-hmm.
The significance of now seeing very extreme attitudes on both sides acquire greater currency, given the current circumstance, takes me back to where we began. I'm very worried that kind of a sentiment takes on a life of its own and becomes much more mainstream, if you can't stop this kind of escalation of violence, which then feeds on itself and creates such enormous anger.
And if that happens, if it continues to happen, because it is happening, obviously, what does that mean? I guess what does it mean for the United States? We've talked a lot about Israel and the Palestinians. What does it mean for the United States in the world?
Well, we have tried very hard to make it clear that the war on terror is a war on terror and not a war on Islam. And one of the things that we have wanted to avoid was the imagery that somehow Osama bin Laden's desire, which was Islam against us, was in fact a scenario that could take place.
But if we soon have both the images that you described in Al Jazeera of Palestinians battling with Israelis and perhaps U.S. troops in Iraq and perhaps still in Afghanistan, do we begin to bring bin Laden's apocalyptic vision to life?
There's a danger, but here again, let's not assume that the Arab governments that exist are passive in this play.
Mm-hmm.
The fact is they will become the victims of that as well. You know, they, on the one hand, they maintain this kind of dual position. On the one hand, they try very hard to ensure that all anger is diverted away from them and onto the Israelis and onto us. On the other hand, they understand that if you allow the bin Laden image to become the dominant feature of the landscape, they will be its first victims. So they're going to have to make some choices, and in our discussions with them, we're going to have to be pretty blunt in terms of the kind of choices they have to make. Now, it doesn't mean that we are indifferent to some of their concerns, but it means it's a two-way street. We each have, as I said, responsibilities to fulfill.
Mm. David Greenway, you've just come back. How about the people on the front line, Israeli soldiers that you talked with, how are they bearing up? And I guess you have to ask the Palestinian young men who are taking the brunt.
Well, I think the army is a little chagrined. They are such a good modern army that could take on any conventional army, but they're not doing so well with guerrillas, and they found that out in the Lebanon. And it was not encouraging to them when they had a tank blown up in Gaza by the Palestinians. And these recent incidences at checkpoints, especially the one where one lone gunman with a World War II carbine managed to kill seven soldiers and three settlers. And all of this is depressing for the army that feels frustrated and ill-used. The number of refuseniks, they call them, the reserve officers who don't want to fight in the occupied territories or serve there, has now grown to over 300.
Mm-hmm. It's a growing number. Jack Beatty, last thoughts here.
Well, there's a column today by David Newman in the Jerusalem Post. He's the chairman of the Department of Politics at Ben-Gurion University. He writes, "But for as long as we are at war, we have to understand that an innocent life lost to this world is precisely that, regardless of what nationality or religion that person represents. Peace, if it ever comes to this tired land, will only be made by those who, despite being exposed to the constant scenes of carnage and destruction, are able to retain their essential humanity and continue to care intensely for every innocent life lost."
Dennis Ross, thanks so much for joining us tonight. You always bring so much to the table. We're very grateful to you for being here.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Dennis Ross is a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He was U.S. point person for both the first Bush White House and the Clinton administration in Middle East peace talks. And David Greenway, fresh back from Israel, and with all your experience at your back, we're very grateful to you for being with us tonight as well. Jack Beatty, this is a conversation that we want to bring to some kind of breakthrough, and maybe we're pushing at some tiny edges of the envelope, but there's so much more. It's overwhelming.
It is overwhelming, and the stakes, as we've just been brought out, are higher and higher every day, especially if we want to make a war on Iraq.
Jack, it's good to have you with us tonight. To learn more about the Saudi Initiative for Peace in the Middle East, check out our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.